Welcome to Merdeka Memories, a series about the challenges and opportunities faced by Singapore's Merdeka generation, men and women who were born in the 1950s and how their experiences have defined the Singapore spirit. I'm Chew Wee Lin, and in this episode, I speak to Dick Lee, the multi-talented Singaporean who's best known for being a singer-songwriter. Although many of his works are embraced today, some of his earliest songs were banned for their colloquial Singapore English or Singlish lyrics. Dick Lee recounts his early struggles as an English-speaking Asian singer-songwriter and describes how he has found success by staying true to himself.
Hello, everybody. I am Dick Lee, actually Richard Lee Peng Boon. I've always been called Dick and Dicky since I was small because I was named after my granduncle. I was born in 1956. I grew up in a Peranakan household. My father was Peranakan and a great lover of music, of jazz particularly. And my mother was a very vivacious and lively lady. She was 13 years younger than him. And she was only 20 when she gave birth to me. So we became quite close when I was growing up. Oh, and one day, when I was about 6 years old, my mother won a piano in a lottery. And a piano arrived in our house. And then we were all made to learn. And I think that is how it started for me. I started to learn how to replicate what I liked. And I started to write music actually when I was about 9 years old. Simple tunes, piano tunes, yeah. By the time I was about 10, 11 years old, I was already very, very active creatively at home. I mean, look, those were the days when we as children had to create our own fun. So it started by me writing piano pieces, and then with my first cousin, Lim Kay Siu, the actor, we were very close. He played the violin, I played the piano. And then I would write violin. I remember writing violin and piano sonatas and all when I was about maybe 11. Not good stuff, but just writing, you know. And of course, my idol was Mozart, who was a child genius, right? At about that time, I watched The Sound of Music, and that inspired me. And those days, the stage club had pantomimes, and I went to see those, like, you know, Cinderella and whatnot. So I started to make my own panto. I started to write plays and create little theatre performances for the family Christmas dinners. So the adults would watch and then we would perform. I did Lady Precious Stream in Peranakan. And then I remember doing a musical called Hilary Rabbit, which I wrote and then directed and all of that. So I was really doing that around 11, 12 years old.
The 1960s were an exciting time for Dick Lee.
When I was about 12, I started to get interested in pop culture. In the 60s, Singapore had a boom of the music industry was really thriving. The Chinese agogo scene emerged. People like Sakura Teng and Rita Chao. So that on the one side, there was this Chinese pop music scene. And then on the other side, there was bands like The Quest and Heather and the Thunderbirds and all. And, you know, like the Beatles came here and things like that. So it was a very lively period. And then I graduated to listening to the music they played on radio and learning about, you know, pop music through that way. And that's how it grew for me. And in the early 70s, when I started to want to write a little bit more, the music industry basically was dead. At the end of the 60s, it all died because of I think National Service, and so all the bands were drafted, and all the whole music industry suddenly disappeared. And that's when I was starting to come of age. And for me to go out and try and be heard was really very, very difficult.
By then, Dick Lee was in secondary school and had been writing musicals for his classmates to perform. He had also formed a singing group called Harmony, and they participated in numerous talent contests known as Talent Times.
And then I left the group basically because I wanted them to sing. I wanted to perform my own songs. The thing to do at that time was to sing cover versions because there was basically no interest in original music. I mean, that was an unheard of thing. People would ask, why? Why do you want to even bother writing songs when there are such great songs out there and things like that? But having a history already, by the time I was 16, of creating my own things, I just wanted to try. So I left the group and I took part in Talent Times, but singing my own material. And of course, with no success, no interest. But I just kept doing it, you know, because it was the only way to be heard. If anything, I would say that growing up at that time taught me was to persevere. And every time, the more I did, the better I got. Because when you sing in front of an audience that doesn't really care about you, that's the toughest challenge. So this perseverance paid off in 1973 when I took part in a Talent Time, sang my own song, and to cut a long story short, got discovered.
What song did you sing?
I sang Life Story at the audition.
Just my life story, minute by second a story.
A song that became the title track of my first album. But the auditioner was Vernon Cornelius, the lead singer of The Quest, whom I idolized. He happened to be working at Rediffusion, and this was a Rediffusion Talent Time. I went and performed the song, and he basically said that he was amazed that there was somebody who wrote music, who wrote songs, and he didn't put me in the competition, and he was right. If I had just gone in, I wouldn't have won, and I would just go to the next competition, which I had been doing, you know. So he put me on as a guest artist that allowed me to come on every week of the competition and perform my own songs. And that's how I started to write lots of songs. And that is how, at the end of that, I wrote Fried Rice Paradise in my first attempt to write a Singapore pop song.
Fried Rice Paradise, sure, it's how it's been described. Book to table, very wise. That is what I would do to jump the queue.
I wrote it at for the finals of that competition and performed it. And one of the judges was an Englishman who worked at EMI, and he loved it. And so he signed me up. And just to show how things were at the time, when he brought me to EMI to, you know, introduce me to them and say, oh, this guy writes a great Singapore song, I got rejected by his boss. They didn't want, they said, what, who cares? I mean, what a strange thing Singapore song like, and what a silly song Fried Rice Paradise. So he threw out the idea. But this guy, his name is Ross Barnett, he actually quit EMI and left the company to fund my album. So he actually paid for my first album, Life Story. He produced it himself with his own money. So that started my career. And then when that album came out, so the thing that happened was the song, Fried Rice Paradise, got banned on local radio, on national radio, because they couldn't get the Singlish part. They thought it was very bad English. So they banned the song. But Rediffusion, because the Talent Time was there, and they are non-government, so they played it. And that's how I got known. But then after that, I went to the army and I didn't do another album for another 10 years.
After completing national service, Dick Lee went to London in 1977 to pursue a degree.
I went to art school and I did fashion because it was easy. I thought it was easy. I didn't realize that, you know, whatever you design, you had to sew yourself. I thought somebody's going to sew for you. So I had to learn how to sew and all that, but it was bad. But I cheated because my mother had a tailor shop, so I sent the drawings back. I bought double fabric, so I would, in the classroom, pretend to sew, but meanwhile, there's a tailor sewing in Singapore. Then they will send it up and I will present that. I did pass and everything at the end. I did learn how to cut and sew. But the most important thing for me during that time was I formed a band. I was very active in the music scene, and I was just, you know, being an art school student, dressing up, going to clubs, and then performing and making recording and all this. But those years were important for me because being abroad, you know, I realized that I would always be a foreigner. There was another incident that changed my life, was that when I made these demos with my friend, I sent them to the biggest publisher called Warner Chappell, and I got an interview. And when I went to the interview, when I walked into the room, he was surprised because I was Asian. He couldn't tell from the music. But he said to me that, you know, as much as I love your music, I think you should say something about being Asian. It doesn't come out in your music. And I thought, well, I thought that wasn't good. You know, I thought, I grew up feeling that it's not good to show that you're Asian. Be as white as possible, you know. But here's a man who said, try and be more me. And then I realized that I did try, but nobody, you know, I didn't get interest, got banned even, right? So I thought, maybe I go back and try again. And that's why I went back. I thought maybe I could find myself better if I went home. Because if I stayed in England, I would just try to be white, you know, because that's what it was like.
Soon after Dick Lee's return to Singapore in 1982, Jimmy Wee, the head of recording company WEA Music, got in touch with him. Jimmy Wee had come to know of Dick Lee from his first album, Life Story, and invited him to get involved in several musical projects.
When I came back in 82, he signed Chris Ho, the DJ, his band called Zircon Lounge. And he got me to help them. So I did arrange some tracks, play keyboards on. I think that was the first album that Jimmy Wee produced. And then the next album he did was Jacinta, which I produced, because I knew her from school. And my own album came the year after, in 1984, called Life in the Lion City. That was the result of what that Warner Chappell man told me to do something Singaporean. I did a whole album, not just one song. All the songs were about a commentary on Singapore. Driving past all the cinemas and shopping centers lining the boulevards. Of course, it didn't take off at all. No one was interested. Because the whole idea of being almost, I mean, we still had a little bit of stigma about things Singaporean, you know? People were still not very receptive, or they would think, why bother? Why is this so strange, you know, right, about Singapore? And the song Life in the Lion City, and the chorus just goes, Singapore, Singapore. Like, no, that was, why are you trumpeting our country name? It's so awkward. Singapore. The other problem at the time was that piracy was very rampant. And you could buy a pirated Michael Jackson cassette is $1. So I remember my cassette was selling at $7 or something like that. You know, so who wants to buy $7 for a local thing, and then, you know, although eventually mine got pirated, which was, then you feel very honored. Wow, okay, my album is so good that they want to pirate it. So that was the problem at that period in the mid 80s.
During this time, Dick Lee was making a living through other pursuits. He recalls how his mother's boutique in Tanglin Shopping Centre ignited his interest in fashion when he was just a teenager.
Okay, so this I have to go back, because when my mother had her shop in the 70s, I was sort of designing for her. The shop was called Mid-Teen, and she sold clothes for girls up to 12. But I was a teenager, and I had friends who were in that awkward age, like not yet woman and all that. So I started designing clothes for teenage girls. And then one time she did this fashion show, and I put it together for her. And I wrote the music for the fashion show. I staged it, I designed the clothes for the fashion show, and I was only 16 years or 17 years old. And this was a very successful charity show. A lot of people came to see. And basically, I started to do fashion shows. I started to produce shows. I started by doing pageants at NUS, Fashion Queen. And from there, I got it. Picked up, noticed by a model agency called El Sayo Models, and I produced shows. I choreographed their shows, $60 a show, I remember. I was very active in the 2 years before NS, age of 16, 17. During that time, I started to get more professional, and I started to do like real fashion shows, like with the top models in Singapore and all of this during that time. Then later on, a model called Carrie Wong, who was a mannequin, this model agency called Mannequin. She was a top model. Then she decided to start her own agency. And because she had worked with me, she got me to help her. So I defected from El Sayo Models to join her. And at 17, 18 years, I was training models. Can you believe it? I was spotting talent on the street, then bringing them to her and training the models. And I was like, I was just a kid, you know, but then that's where my event management part of my life happened. It grew from that. When I went to London and I was in the fashion college, I produced all the graduation shows because I knew how to. And when I came back on vacation, I was choreographing shows for Carrie models. Eventually, when Carrie left and she went to France with a French husband, I took over the company. Me and my partner Linda Teo, who still runs it to this day. So I became a model agent even. And then Linda and I started to do, I started an event company called Runway Productions the year I came back from London. So that was my job for a good 7-8 years. And I was the only, and possibly the only and the top fashion show production company in Singapore. And I was doing very well, you know. And then I started to do event management for like car launches and all of these things during that time. All at the same time, recording albums, at the same time, designing clothes.
Having produced several Singapore apparel shows which featured key players in the local fashion scene, Dick Lee noted that creativity was lacking on the catwalk.
Where are the local designers? They were there, but they were all designing for the factories that produce collections for department stores.
To raise the profile of the local fashion industry, Dick Lee decided to start a society of local designers, based on the fact that Fashion Week in other countries was always guided by an association or committee.
So I contacted the local designers. I made friends with them all. Then I said, let's all form a society and association. We call ourselves SODA.
SODA stands for the Society of Designing Arts.
And I was like the creative director, and because I was also a designer. And so we all came together to design clothes. And I got Tangs to sponsor the fashion show and sell our clothes for a period in the department store. 1 month in fact. And that was the first time in the history of Singapore where local designers put their name on the label and sold in a department store. And then eventually the designers started to get known. Designers like Esther Tay, people like Francis Chong. There was a girl called Jude Ling, who still has a business called Future State. It's still going on now. David Wang, Thomas Wee, you know, all these designers were... And this started the whole Singapore designer thing. And then people like Carrie Models, where I was working, started to do local designer shows at hotels, tea shows, you know, and things like that. And that time there was a very big thing called Secretary's Week every year in April. And every Secretary's Week, there're fashion shows. And so the local designers started to do that. So much so that in 1986, basically due to bad recession, properties being empty, we were given a space, a 3,000 square feet space in Delphi Orchard. And we opened a shop called Hemispheres. And this was the first emporium of local designers. And so all these designers, now they could have a permanent space within this Delphi Orchard. And that ran for about 4 or 5 years until property went good again. They took back the space. But it launched fashion in the 80s. And meanwhile, I was doing my event business, getting bigger and bigger. By the mid-80s, I probably had about 10 staff. And we were doing all the big shows. And then one of my clients was a cigarette company. And those days, cigarette companies were allowed to do promotions. And they had a lot of money. For me, I got my client, which was Salem, to sponsor my album. They paid for my album, and then I used the album and performed in nightclubs and all that to promote the cigarettes. Because local albums didn't sell, but they cost money to make. So it was very costly for Warner to keep pumping out money. So that's how I funded, I helped Warner to fund my album, and that's how I ended up having... In the 80s, I had 6 albums. I think the first 2 was directly by Warner, and then the rest was sponsored.
So did that help to boost your music career?
No, not at all, because the sales were so poor. You know, my cassettes for the cigarette-sponsored ones were given away free, like free gifts and all that. So it was used in that way, you see. So the thing that changed everything for me was that in the 80s, the government started to create these national songs for National Day Parade. They created 4 songs from 1984. And it changed things in terms of national identity and national pride. So much so that by 1988, people were more receptive to being Singaporean and to understanding what being Singaporean was about. And by then, Michael Chiang had done a very successful comedy called Army Days, which was very local, about NS, and led me to work with him to create Beauty World, the musical, in 1988. And that took off really well. That led me to say, maybe I want to try a Singapore album again. I did Life in Lion City in 1984. In 1989, I released The Mad Chinaman. And by then, the difference between 1984 and 1989 was that the public went for it. Although one thing happened, Rasa Sayang, which was the opening track on the album, had a rap in Singlish. Again, the radio station banned the song, therefore banning the album. Why? Because it was in Singlish. You see, when they banned it, the press supported me and made a big stink and said, what is this? We are... And I think, you know, the media said, enough's enough, this is what we are, and we're not promoting it, we're just celebrating it, you know. And so they unbanned it, and then it really took off, and it went to platinum sales, within 3 months, you know. So having the public acknowledge it was the best thing for me, after all these years, you know. That was my 8th album, you know. And with that came international recognition, because then that's where my career took off when I went to Japan. In 1990, I moved my whole life up to Japan. And I left my event business, and I never looked back. And I mean, that was a big dream come true, because during that time, you know, we all looked up to Japan for, coolness.
What is it about your music that appealed to them?
I think they like its Asianness, because we are being multicultural. They were not clear about what Singapore was. After the Second World War and all of that, they sort of they turned away from all the atrocities that they committed, and they just didn't want to think about. And then they turned westwards. So the year that I appeared, 1989 to 1990, was a bad year for them, because they were experiencing Japan bashing in the United States. That was a year when Americans were burning Japanese cars and all of that, because they looked too much to the West, you know. Then they started to turn inwards. So I came at a time when they started to recognize that maybe we better be part of Asia. This was also, remember, the Pacific century was looming. I mean, this was talked about, and they said that Asia is going to become important. So I was there, and I probably spearheaded the Asian boom, because in 1992, I did this big musical called Nagaland, which was about Asian identity. It was a pan-Asian musical, and very significantly sponsored by Mitsubishi Electric. So they went to fund my musical, which millions of dollars, because our cast was from all over Asia. We did a Japanese tour. We went to Hong Kong and Singapore, so it was like a big Asian tour.
Amid preparations for Nagaland in 1992, Dick Lee took time off to marry his old friend and frequent musical collaborator, Jacintha Abishagunaden. He explains why he decided to do so ahead of such a major production.
Yeah, that was the worst time to get married, probably. It was during that thing. But, you know, it just felt right. I don't know. You know, we've known each other all our lives as well. And she was my muse. When I started writing, she was the voice of my songs. So we were very, very close and everything, and we just thought that it was a good thing to do. I don't know. I was about, already 34, 35. I thought, time to settle down. I was thinking of it already before this Nagaland and all that. The other thing that happened for her was that also her career took off at that time. I was in Japan, and she went and did Cats. Grisabella, you know, the best role, and she went to Australia to rehearse for months and all. So it just it's true what they say about showbiz couples. It's very hard to maintain, especially when we are working all over the place.
What is it about her that inspires you so much?
Well, her voice. I mean, she's got the most beautiful voice of anyone I've ever heard in Singapore, for sure. I see. And also that she was the interpreter of my songs. and she understood me.
The couple divorced in early 1996. That same year, Dick Lee became involved in several music-related projects, most notably as a creative advisor to Hong Kong's first modern musical, Snow Wolf Lake. He wrote several tunes for the production, including the theme song, Love is Forever.
And then I got headhunted to work at Sony Music Asia as the vice president of A&R, Artists and Repertoire, doing a corporate job. I didn't do anything creative, and I just couldn't take it. And then in 2000, I got headhunted to come back and join MediaWorks in their ill-fated English channel. That lasted a year. Then we were all retrenched. And then I started to have to reinvent myself. It was a bit of a confusing period. But the interesting thing that happened for me is that I then got hired to direct NDP in 2002. And I was the first individual creative director, you know, before it was done by committee. So I'm quite proud of having a few of these firsts in my life. I think what is great about growing up in the times that I have is that I've always had these opportunities and the means and eventually the support to do my own thing, but also to do the thing that is a Singaporean thing. I think that's very, very important for me.
Today, Dick Lee continues to do what he's done his whole life.
Dabble in music, dabble in fashion, dabble in producing shows.
He co-founded Dick Lee Asia in 2016, a joint venture dealing in music, creative direction, consultancy and other services. In 2017, he added film director to his lengthy list of titles, having co-written and co-directed a movie titled Wonder Boy that was inspired by his teen years. When asked what his proudest achievements have been, Dick Lee had this to say.
The few awards I've had have all been very meaningful. Cultural Medallion, I was like the first pop artist to get that. It told me that, you know what, I'm doing the right thing. I mean, I didn't get it because I do pop. I think I got it because I did a Singaporean thing, you know, in what I do. But the other thing is, and it happens like every time I hear, you know, 30,000 people sing Home. That was written when I was in Hong Kong. And it wasn't written for National Day. It was written for a Sing Singapore campaign. And it's just that one of the panel was NDP chairman, so he put it in NDP in 1998. And Kit Chan sang it. So it was not well received at first because there was a complaint that the first line is negative whenever I'm feeling low. How can you start an NDP song with a negative line like that? But as you can see, it has really taken off.
Dick Lee's song Home has become a firm favourite among Singaporeans and was even voted the most popular National Day Parade song in an online poll in 2013.
You know, even 20 years on, I feel that, wow, when I did the Mad Chinaman, I wanted to use folk songs, but I realised we had none. All the folk songs we have are from China or Malay or Indonesia or somewhere. So I thought maybe I could write a folk song for the future. And maybe Home is it, because 20 years later, the folks are singing it. So I hope that will be my legacy. For this is where I know I'm home.